You are listening to the Horse Radio Network, part of the Equine Network family.
This is episode 163 of Retired Racehorse Radio on Horse Radio Network, part of Equine Network, brought to you by Kentucky Performance Products and Equestrian Plus. Retired Racehorse Radio is your guide to the adoption, care, and training of the retired racehorse, brought to you in cooperation with Retired Racehorse Project and New Vocations Racehorse Adoption Program.
On today's show, we're learning more about equine podiatry and how it can help our ex-racehorses with one of the best in the business, Travis Burns of Virginia Tech. Then we chat with New Vocations' Bridget Hollern for a new training tip and adoptable horse of the week. Stay tuned.
And they're off on Retired Racehorse Radio, the podcast that is your guide to the adoption, care, and training of the retired racehorse.
This is Kristen Kovach-Bentley in Jamestown, New York.
And this is Lee Beamer in Withville, Virginia, and you're listening to Retired Racehorse Radio.
Well, Lee, the time has changed, so now we're recording this. I mean, it's always been kind of dark by the end of the recordings, but now it's like straight up dark.
Yeah, and it's basically midnight is what it feels like.
Yeah. Now, I have gone on record on this show before to be like, I don't mind. I like the seasons. This year, because we are trying to treat Shorty twice a day still with the Lyme's meds for like another couple of weeks, it is like, okay, listen, it is real dark. So now that I understand like how normal people who probably don't appreciate like the seasonality the way I do, how they function, I'm like, okay, it's a little dark. It's also problematic because the farm turned out a new bull today and he's a little aggressive and I'm not looking forward to running into him in the dark. So I got to figure that one out.
That's fun. And that's Is he all black?
Yes. He has one white ear tag. So I'll see that coming before I die. So that'll be good.
That's something to keep your eye out for.
Yeah. Be like, oh no. Yeah. It's like, yeah. Yeah. When we get one like that, Eric calls it the night fury because you won't see him until it's way too late there after dark. So
yeah.
Oh, just goodness. Keeping it spicy here at the farm, you know.
Well, what a fun time to make that change.
Right, yeah. Like the day after the time changes. So.
Right. Why not? One more fun thing in the mix there.
Yeah. I mean, my horses normally do come in for the year. So because we're on this, like, A, we had a really dry summer, so the pasture died, like, way earlier than it normally does. We've had to move some things around. There's a water project happening on the farm where they're, like, digging ditches all over the place. So we've been sort of dancing around this project with both the cattle herd and the horses, trying to figure out, like, where we can put all these animals that they're not going to, A, fall in a ditch, or B, like, drive the ditch man crazy, because, like, cattle and horses are always like, oh, what are you doing? You know, and have to put their faces in everything. I cannot imagine like trying to be this guy, like doing his job. And then like Shorty Harmon is like, hello, you know, like in his face trying to figure out like what's going on. So, so that's been complicating things. And then, with the twice a day meds, I'm like, okay, so I've been keeping them in at night and in is still out, but it's like a much smaller like kind of corral that they live in for the winter and then out during the day. But now that I'm potentially dodging this bull, we might be calling it a little early for the year, just bringing them in for the winter. So got to figure that one out still. I don't know.
You know, anything to make life a little bit easier.
Yeah. Horses aren't hard enough on their own. So we just to make it much more complicated by adding a bunch of cows and this ditch guy. So ditch guy seems very nice, but
I mean, I can't tell you how many pictures I've got of my horses when we were doing our water stuff on the farm. I mean, I know those guys were so annoyed, but Bert was really trying to be helpful. I don't think he ever helped much, but
oh my god, how is Bert? What's Bert up to these days?
Oh, Bert's just up to being ornery, you know, same as usual. He is trained to pull a cart now, which is hilarious because he has like a little tiny workhorse harness.
Does he have a collar or like a breast collar?
Yes.
Style?
Yeah.
Oh, he has a collar.
He has a collar.
That's precious. I love that.
So funny. Like a tiny little draft. So he's pretty roadworthy. He's pretty legit out there. The other horses, of course, were, you know, when he first came back, I think last year from his month of training, I sent him off. They were all very alarmed of what was following him around so closely, but they've gotten used to it. And
Gosh.
It's fun. It's like a little sports car.
I love that. We had a pony when I taught at Alfred University. We had I think he was a large Shetland maybe, but like a proper pony and a little pony cart.
Oh.
And you know, you could zip all over the place with him. But I was like, you could park this thing anywhere. Like you could drive it into a stall and turn it around and we would drive him on campus. And yeah, it was a good time.
Yeah. Good fun.
And it is, I mean, it's good exposure too for your other horses just to see it, because we used to drive the drafts around when I first got Jobber and he was like, huh. And he got used to it right away, which in retrospect was good, because the year prior to my year at the makeover, there was a combined driving event happening at the same time. Mm-hmm. And they were like, oh yeah, a lot of the thoroughbreds didn't like that. I was like, yeah, I bet they didn't. Like things go around at speed. Shocker. Those aren't good things to combine. So.
No.
But I was always, like, I'll be ready if that's there. Turned out it wasn't there, but I was ready anyway.
It's always good to be prepared. Finn's first recognized show was at Tryon last year, I guess 2024. And they were having a drive-in event at the same time. And there were all these tiny little ponies everywhere.
Oh, my God.
Pulling their carts. You know, some of the horses were scared. But, you know, I guess at that point, Finn hadn't even seen Bert pull a cart. But she didn't mind. She's luckily very level-headed.
She's a sensible girl. Yeah.
Yes. And for that, we are thankful. Yes.
Well, we have Finn to thank for our main guest tonight, because Finn and Travis go way back, don't they?
Yeah, I guess about 2.5 years Finn and I have known Travis, and he is the best in the business, in my opinion. He's really made a difference in Finn's life and keeping her happy. So excited to chat with him and see what all he has to say about thoroughbreds and their feet and all the cool stuff he's seen over the years. He's just a wealth of knowledge and a great person to be around. So I think we'll have a good chat.
Awesome. I'm excited to see if we either debunk any of these thoroughbred foot myths or confirm them or both.
Yeah. Well, Finn's not a good, model for thoroughbred feet, certainly. But,
well, you know, it's like I told my husband though once, you know, he's like, why are these horses so much more complicated? You know, these thoroughbreds. I was like, no, it's not because they're thoroughbreds. It's because we are treating them like sport horses for the first time and not just backyard horses.
Yes.
And that is the ultimate difference. It's not necessarily the breed of them. It is what your goals are and what you're trying to do with them and how much you are treating them as an athlete versus livestock or a pet, you know, right. And they can be in all of those things at the same time. All of those.
Absolutely. Goals. Yeah. It's good to get them set up for success though. Makes a big difference.
For sure.
And it's a process.
It very much is a journey. But that's what we're all here for at Retired Racehorse Radio, is that journey, no matter what stage of the journey you are at. And I want to give a shout out to our longtime sponsor, Kentucky Performance Products, who has been in support of us every single step of the way. So we'll hear a message from them next.
When your horse loses significant amounts of electrolytes and fluids as he sweats, problems such as dehydration, muscle cramping, fatigue, tying up, and colic may occur. Even in mild forms, these conditions can have a negative impact on your horse's ability to perform and recover after exercise. Research shows that electrolytes help regulate nerve and muscle function and maintain a healthy fluid balance. Summer Games Electrolyte is formulated to replenish electrolytes and trace minerals that are lost when your horse sweats, regardless of the season. It also stimulates the thirst response so he continues to drink and stay properly hydrated. For more information, visit kppusa.com or call 859-873-2974. Well, we are very excited to have Travis Burns with us today on Retired Racehorse Radio. I've had the pleasure of knowing him, me and Finn, for about 2.5 years now. He's taken real good care of her feet and excited to chat with him about his experiences. So welcome, Travis. Thanks for being with us.
Yeah, thank you guys for having me.
Yeah.
Privilege and an honor.
So you've had quite a career and farriery, and what got you started down this path?
So what got me started down the path of becoming a farrier, I would say it all started when I was a child. So I grew up in Western North Carolina, and my family there ran a trail guide service in the Great Smoky Mountains National Park. And so there, my uncle managed this trail guide service with, I don't know, anywhere between 30 to 50 horses at any given time. And him and my dad and my uncle would actually shoe those horses. And I was a little rambunctious as a child and wasn't really allowed to be around while that was happening. And so naturally, I kind of became obsessed with it, wanted to know what was happening. I mean, it's quite a sight to see a farrier working, you know, beating on an anvil, you know, nailing a shoe onto a horse's foot, you know, to a 10-year-old kid. That's very, very intriguing. And so I think that's really where I developed the interest and just started to watch them more and more and more. And then as I got older, obviously they helped me learn. They let me pull off shoes and finish feet and do things like that. And then it really just continued to grow from there. But definitely the horse background comes from my two uncles, my Uncle Donnie and Timmy, that really got me started.
Yeah, it definitely sounds like a good way to get started in it and be interested.
Okay, and I have to ask, because I have actually gone on a few different trail rides in Western North Carolina as a kid, mm-hmm. and now I'm like, oh my God, what if I ran into like young Travis? So where yep. were those located?
It would have been, it was in the Great Smoky Mountains National Park, just north of Cherokee on Highway 441 North. It's called Smokemont Riding Stables. It's actually the only one on the North Carolina side of the park.
Okay, I say this like I'm going to have any kind of childhood memory of the name of the place, but I had a great time, so I'm going to say in my memory that it was your family's place. I love that.
Well, you might remember it was just north of an Indian reservation, so a place, you know, a big tourist area with teepees, a casino, stuff like that, and then it's right beside a primitive campground. Most people remember it for the campground more than the trail guide service. It has a really, really big primitive campground area right there.
I do remember having a great time on the horses, so I remember that part at least, which is good.
Well, I hope it was that one, and I hope I was your trail guy.
Yeah, yeah, that would have been great. I love that. So now looking at your, you know, kind of like resume, like you've gone literally all over the world with this. So, you know, I know like the saying is like polo is your passport to the world, and I probably have botched that saying, but like it turns out so is shoeing horses. So like how have you ended up in all the places you've ended up?
I've been really, really lucky to see lots of places through my farrier career. So I grew up, again, like I said, in Western North Carolina, in a pretty rural Appalachia area where you don't really leave the county very much. And so after I went off to college and became a farrier, I had the opportunity to work for some farriers in Northern Virginia, a multi-farrier practice there called Forging Ahead. And that's really the first time I really started to travel beyond just going off to Knoxville and then Raleigh for school. There, I would travel up and down the East Coast and have the opportunity to shoe horses in many, many different states. Based on the reputation of the multi-farrier practice I worked for. You know, they really opened the doors and I was young and able to travel with some of those farriers to their clients in, you know, Florida, New Hampshire, South Carolina, Georgia, really just all over. And so that was kind of the start from there. And then honestly, the first time I got to speak at a national conference was, again, based on the reputation of that practice. So the first time I got to speak was actually by invitation in Saratoga, New York. So there used to be these, I forget what she called them, but there's a lady named Fran Yerga who would conduct during the Saratoga races. She would have these Tuesday night talks in a random pub there. And I got to speak there. She invited me to come up and speak, and it was really, really nice. Another farrier named Mike Wildenstein, who was the resident farrier at the University of, or Cornell University. He was the farrier there for a long time. He was also speaking there that night, and both got to give a presentation. That was really the first time I got to speak in a public venue, but that was through a connection. The guy that was the founder of the multi-farrier practice I worked for, named Paul Goodness. He had a great relationship with her, and on his recommendation, she invited me, allowed me to do that. And then from there, I just was lucky. I was in a lot of right places at a lot of the right times, and got invited to speak at venues from, you know, many, many different states to England, Colombia, Chile, Canada, Grenada, you know, many, many different countries, which has been excellent. But I think a lot of it is just pure luck. I was in the right place, the right time, met the right people, got an invitation and was willing to go. But that's the way I've been able to see a lot of places around the world, just through the farrier profession.
Yeah, that's definitely quite the doors you've had open for you with all your connections and some great experiences. And one thing I'm curious about, Travis, is what is the difference between, you know, a farrier and a podiatrist?
What is the difference between a farrier and a podiatrist?
Yeah.
To be honest with you, I don't know that there is one. So Okay. Podiatrist is obviously it's a human medical term to talking about problems with the foot. And so I can speak to it a little bit about kind of the start of us here at the Virginia Maryland College of Veterinary Medicine. So we started out, it was myself and a veterinarian named Dr. Scott Pleasant. And so we chose the term then to call ourselves the Equine Podiatry Service, really because it kind of has a medical connotation, and that service, we thought that title probably described us best as a joint effort between a farrier and a veterinarian that had a very specific interest in the foot, or the horse's foot, obviously. And so I still think of it that way, as kind of podiatry is a team, or really maybe even the vet farrier. You know, there are several vets that are also farriers who focus and specialize in therapeutic shoeing and everything involving the equine hoof capsule. And so I think that's perfectly fair. But in my mind, I think of the term podiatrist or podiatry as including a medical component. So when Dr. Pleasant left the college, we did rename and rebrand ourselves into the farrier service, because at the end of the day, that's what I am. I am a farrier, and I'm proud of that profession, and I'm happy to be one. And I wanted to make sure to kind of remove that medical connotation to the clients, to make sure that I wasn't false advertising or anything like that. But to be honest with you, I don't know. There's a lot of people that will use that term. There's a lot of farriers that use the term podiatrist or equine podiatry. And I don't know. It kind of has a blurred gray line. But to me, I identify myself as a farrier. But when I was working with Dr. Pleasant, and now Dr. Amy is there in the service, or even with any of the other vets in the hospital, whether it's the surgery team or the equine sports medicine team or whatever, I think about us as a podiatry team, a podiatry unit. But in my mind, it has a medical connotation, and it's a joint effort between vets and farriers. But
I
that's
like
not
that
standard
definition
across the board.
Okay, that's interesting to know. That was going to be my next question, is like, is there like a standard definition? But I like your, you know, kind of group approach, like farrier first, but, you know, vet team. Because I've worked with, I had a horse with a keratoma removed last winter and ended up sending him down to Kentucky to do his stall rest, assuming he was going to like mutilate himself if I tried to do it here. So I was like, I will just pay a friend with a nicer barn to do that. Sure. And he ended up having a couple follow-up appointments with Root and Riddle's podiatrist. And I was like, ooh, absolutely. I don't know exactly what that is, but it sounds very fancy, you know? So I was like, I'm going to pay for the service, but it makes more sense because, you know, I think they were coming from that whole, you know, group vet practice to take a look.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, the equine podiatry team at Root and Riddle, I mean, it is a group of vets and farriers. You know, I mean, a lot of them, they do many of those clinicians there, you know, whether it's Dr. Morrison or Dr. Fleming or whoever, a lot of them are vets and farriers. But even them, they work with a team of farriers there as a part of that unit. And, you know, the Root and Riddle Podiatry Program was started by Dr. Morrison and a farrier. And Dr. Morrison is actually alumni from the Virginia Maryland College of Veterinary Medicine. And so we've had a wonderful working relationship over the years. And I think probably part of what he built there in that title was another reason why Dr. Pleasant here wanted to kind of brand ourselves or have that title, Equine Podiatry.
Yeah. Okay. That makes sense. Yeah. Cause I did hear, like, I didn't get to be there, you know, for the appointment, but I did hear, you know, they're like, oh yes, the podiatrist and the farrier came out. And I was like, oh, so it's two separate people, or at least I guess like someone was putting the shoe on and someone else was not. So I was like trying to figure out like, okay, what is this? Like who all is on this team? You know?
Sure. And chances are, if you were there, it was probably pretty great. You know, I mean, you wouldn't be surprised to see the vet trim the foot and the, in that group. And the farrier shape a shoe, and one of them put it on, and you know, you wouldn't be surprised to see the vet taking the radiograph and the farrier jumping in there and holding the plate or holding the horse and being assistant. Like it really is a team approach.
Right. So I think my horse kicked the podiatrist, but not the farrier, if I remember correctly. So
yeah. Well, then it may not have been a team approach. They all might have left.
Well, that's why I was like, oh, sorry, guys. Well, I will say he's been much better since then. So I think whatever they did to him down there, he's like, okay, no, I'm a good boy now. So my bad.
Well,
I wasn't there.
When Finn started going to Travis, she had to be sedated, but we have come a long way from that now. And we're past that. But
she's wonderful. She just comes in, but she does have a timer there.
She does.
Knows when you get done on that last foot, and she's like, I'm leaving.
She's ready.
You guys want to talk or not? I'm going.
Yeah.
It's time to go.
She does walk herself out, but she's funny. So a good thought that I have is, you know, with Finn, obviously we needed to get a specialized team involved, and it got to that point where the farrier we had was, you know, kind of open and honest with me about that. But in your mind, is there like a place where horse owners or thoroughbred owners or whoever should kind of keep in the back of their mind that maybe they do need to seek out a bigger team, somebody who maybe feels more comfortable with the job? Like what would be some signs to you that maybe that would be time for that?
So what would be some signs that it might be time for someone else to take a stab at it or take a peek?
Right.
Yeah, I don't know that I have very specific, clear guidelines that would say that you need it. I think often, I guess I can describe more what we're typically presented with. So it's typically, you know, something's going on. The horse is losing a lot of shoes, or there's a crack that won't go away, or there's this nebulous, insidious lameness that no one has been able to easily identify. You know, it's just not quite right. I would say that's the predominant time that we're called in as a team. From a farrier perspective, one of the common things we have other farriers refer or send cases to us for is one of them, probably the biggest by far, is the horse is just simply unable to keep shoes on, and the farrier has run out of enough hoof wall to feel safe and comfortable in nailing shoes on. Mm-hmm. And so we get called in a lot, or clients will come to us for one or two or three shoeing cycles to apply glue on shoes to get them over that hump and allow them to have enough hoof wall to be able to safely and securely nail to. But I would say most of the cases we get that come to us it's typically triggered by the farrier or the vet. One of those two sees something that they're not quite familiar with, or they just don't think is going in the right direction. And they typically initiate the referral process. You know, I'd say it's rare for us to just get a phone call from a client and say, hey, I just need help. That's probably the minority. But I think oftentimes when that occurs, it's something's just not quite right, or no one really knows their horse better than the owner, right? Like you guys see them, you're around them all the time. And so, you know, something's not quite going right. And you've probably talked to your vet about it. You've probably talked to your farrier about it. And maybe you're just not quite sure about the answers they're getting, or maybe they're not seeing the same things you are as the owner. And we get some of those client calls. But I know that's a really roundabout answer and not really black and white, but I think that referral process, or when something's not quite right and you need someone else, a lot of that really is just a gut feeling, whether it's from the farrier or the vet or the owner. Like I said, you guys know them the best, and And when your horse is, something's changed, you're often the first people to pick up on it and want something different or another opinion or consultation.
I do think it is helpful to know, though, that most of your cases are referred from the farrier or the vet and not like, you know, because otherwise, like, it's very easy for us all to be like helicopter moms, right? And be like, I don't know, his feet look funny. I better get the podiatrist involved, you know, and like not necessarily maybe need that, but just, you know, someone who's like a little too obsessive about it. So I think it's helpful to know that, like, most of the time it's, you know, from like, yes, I have hunches. Most of the time my hunches are wrong just because I'm insane. So, you know, like, I'm worrying too much about something. So it's helpful to know, like, you know, have a good vet and farrier team first who will talk you off the ledge and then politely put you in touch with a team, you know, when things do need to escalate. So, so that is good to know. So Travis, I have a question, and we're not a propaganda podcast, so there's no wrong answer to this. Do you find that thoroughbreds have worse feet than other breeds?
120%.
Ooh, a hot take. All right, tell us more.
Yeah, no, I think I will preface that by, I have spent the majority of my career mostly shoeing thoroughbreds and warm bloods. I would much rather shoe those two breeds than anything else. I'm 6 foot one, and they're much more comfortable for me to work on than the little quarter horse. Now, that being said, those little quarter horses, those little Appaloosas, they often have 3 times the thickness of hoof wall of any thoroughbred I've ever seen. So they typically have a better hoof quality, but they're just not comfortable for me to work on. So I love working on thoroughbreds and warm bloods, but I do think the thoroughbreds, for the size that they are, have typically very thin hoof walls. They typically have very flat feet, you know, minimal sole depth. A lot of them have a broken back hoof pastern access. They often have a long pastern, which is associated with a long sloping foot. And so they do have foot issues, for sure. And like I said, I work at a referral hospital, and I have for the majority of my career. So the majority of my career have been presented with horses that other people have already had issues with. So it's probably a biased view. Like, I don't get to trim that many horses. I probably shouldn't say that in front of Lee, but I probably only trim 20 horses in my practice. The majority of them, you know, need some kind of shoe pad combination, something to stay sound. So I don't get the opportunity to see a lot of the good footed horses or the barefoot horses. And so most of the
thoroughbreds I guess that is a good point, right? Like, the ones with a good foot don't make their way to you. Yeah.
Right. No, exactly. So it's a total biased view. But the thoroughbreds, they don't have a ton of hoof wall thickness, and they usually don't have a lot of cup or sole depth in the bottom of their feet.
Well, and, you know, if you do see enough of that, that's enough to indicate it's a pattern, right? Like, not like,
one or two
funky ones. Yeah.
No, I don't think you'll get an argument out of anybody that shoes a lot of thoroughbreds. That's just what their feet look like, but it helps them go really fast.
So, right. Yeah. It is a little bit of a form to function.
Absolutely.
There. So now, and things like a thin hoof wall and poor sole depth, can that be rehabilitated over time?
I think it could be managed. I don't know that it's rehabilitated to the point where it's, I guess, in essence, fixed. Like, you hear this term corrective farriery all the time, and I don't think a horse is programmed that's going to have X amount of thickness of hoof wall. You know, and thoroughbreds, you know, a half inch thick would be amazing. That's a lot of thickness for a thoroughbred, but for a draft horse, a half inch is nothing. Right. Mm-hmm. And so I think the thoroughbreds, those feet, the thin walls and flat feet or minimal sole depth can absolutely be managed. And we can apply shoes that help protect the hoof wall or limit shoe loss. And you can absolutely use pads and other frog and sole support combinations to protect the sole depth. But they typically, you know, improve and reach a point, and that's as far as they go. So they, you know, if you just go and look at two horses, look at a thoroughbred and a quarter horse's foot, the quarter horse is going to have more hoof wall thickness. And I don't know that you can't make the thoroughbred have the same thickness as the quarter horse. Mm-hmm. And sure, there's a few outliers in there. Don't get me wrong. That's not 100% accurate, but by far and away, the thoroughbreds, they just, a half inch thick hoof wall was about the thickest you'll ever see.
Mm-hmm. Now, do you ever work on a lot of standardbreds? I'm curious how they stack up.
I do not. We have a couple in our teaching herd, and they typically have pretty upright feet and really thick mm-hmm. hoof walls and really good sole depth. So they look quite different from a just hoof morphologic standpoint.
Right. Yeah. Now it's interesting because I know you mentioned warm bloods too, and there is a lot of, you know, thoroughbred blood in the warm blood mm-hmm. side. And there increasingly some, you know, depending on what kind of branch of quarter horses you're working with, there's a fair amount of thoroughbred coming into some parts of the quarter horse mm-hmm. world as well. So, sure. you know, if you're working on poor warm blood feet, by comparison, are there, you know, things you might see in the warm bloods that you don't see in the thoroughbreds and vice versa?
Yeah. I think the warm bloods typically have more foot wall thickness. They tend to have just a more robust foot in general. Mm-hmm. They tend to have more sole depth and more hoof wall thickness. And really, I think from a hoof wall standpoint, those are the two things you need for long-term soundness. And they typically have more sole depth and more hoof wall thickness. But I guess I also do a small number of performance horses and a lot of the general area I live in, a lot of them that are, you know, they're high level dressage riders or three eventers or something. A lot of them just have warm bloods. That's what they compete with.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Yeah. And I guess, yeah, it goes back to that form to function, right? Cause a thoroughbred is really intentionally bred for speed. Yeah. And you're not doing things that warm bloods are doing or drafts or anything else. So yeah, it does track. It does make sense. All right. I am curious, what is there like a case that stands out in your memory that was one of your most rewarding things that you've, you know, worked on, like helping a horse that jumps out that you're like, yes, that was my favorite. Other than Finn, of course.
Yeah, no, I can speak to it. And I don't mean to pick on Finn. Finn's a great, great horse, but my absolute favorite horse I've ever worked on is a horse named Mo. And he was actually an Appaloosa, but he's one of the first horses I saw here when I moved to Blacksburg and started working at Virginia Tech. He came in April of that year, so April of 2010, and presented with a keratoma. And so that was the first case here that we worked as a vet fair team to remove a keratoma. I'd previously worked at NC State and up at the EMC in Northern Virginia, so I'd been a part of those processes before, but he was our first one here, kind of the start of our program here. And then I got to continue to shoe him for another 14 or 15 years. And he never swished a tail the wrong way. He never moved a muscle the wrong way. This is the absolute best behaved horse I've ever met in my life. And I will never forget him. I went with that client. I got to watch, that horse's owner was obviously a mom, but a daughter. And I got to watch her grow from middle school all the way. She's now finished law school. And so I think it was rewarding on a lot of different levels to not only get to stay with a horse for 15 years, but to watch the kids grow up, to get to know the family. Actually, I had surgery on my hand one time, and that the owner of Mo came down and ran anesthesia herself for me for that. Wow. For that surgery. So I think a very rewarding thing. And then I got to follow that horse to probably 10 different farms as they moved around over their career. And he went on and got leased out, and another small child started riding him, and getting to watch some grow like that. So if you made me pin down on one horse, one case, he's always the one I think of.
I love that. And you know, it is fun, you know, because yeah, like practitioners on our horses really do become part of the family. So it's nice that, you know, you can have that relationship with someone like that and mm-hmm. horses like that. So I love that.
Absolutely. And going to you at Tech is really made such a positive impact in Finn's life. So, you know, thanks for being along for the ride and helping her out. And, you know, it's great to have a team like that. So we're thankful.
Absolutely. No, we're happy to do it. You've got a big team there to support everybody.
Yeah. Tech is great. Big plug for Virginia Tech.
Yeah. Yeah. Put that in there every 30 seconds.
That's right. Oh, goodness. Well, thank you for coming and being with us this evening, Travis. It was a good conversation. I feel like we learned a lot about all your experiences.
Can you just remind listeners where they can learn more about what you're doing specifically at Virginia Tech? But then, you know, if anyone is interested in equine podiatry, maybe some good resources for people to learn more.
Yeah. So some good resources to learn more about equine podiatry. I think there are a lot of really good websites out there providing a lot of good scientific research. And actually one of them that has the most is by Dr. Stephen O'Grady. And actually, I think his website is equipodiatry.com, if I type that in correctly. But he has a lot of really good research papers that are, he has free access there. And yeah, it is equipodiatry.com or Virginia Therapeutic Farriery. So he has a lot of those resources out there. But I think over the last several years from a equine podiatry or farrier standpoint, there's been a lot more scientific research go into that. So all of the journals from Equine Veterinary Education, Equine Veterinary Journal, any of those are great resources if you can get them. There's a great resource out there called the American Farriers Journal. They have a lot of really good information. The American Farriers Association has the No Foot, No Horse Journal, and they're starting a research journal as well. I think that's a great learning resource. And then for you guys, I'm guessing the target audience is thoroughbred people. And there are some really good books out there written by Dr. Simon Curtis. One of them, I think a lot of horse owners would be really interested in that have thoroughbreds, and it's called Hoofcare Farrier or Farriery Foal to Racehorse. And so it talks about thoroughbreds and their hoof care and angular limb deformities and, you know, their whole first several years of life, all the way up to being a racehorse and kind of the common disease pathologies, the common conformations you'll see with thoroughbreds. That's a really good book and a nice easy read with a lot of good information in it. And then he's written three or four other books, but he has two named Corrective Farriery Volume 1 and 2. And I think those are good resources as well. But there's lots of good ones out there. But like anything, I would just say, don't believe everything you read on the internet, but those research journals, the textbooks, the actual trade magazines, those are all great resources.
Love that. Well, Travis, thank you so much. That was very enlightening. And of course, yes, now we have plenty of reading to do and some homework for ourselves. So thanks again for joining us on Retired Racehorse Radio.
Yeah, no, thank you guys.
Recharge your training program with Equestrian Plus. Equestrian Plus brings together the top riders, trainers, and professionals onto one video platform. Watch over 5,000 how-to training videos, clinic and event footage, exclusive training sessions, and more, featuring top experts including 5-time dressage Olympian Stefan Peters, International Grand Prix dressage competitor Anna Baffini, Olympic dressage team bronze medalist Laura Graves, and many more. Join Equestrian Plus now and use promo code HRN15 for 15% off your first month. Visit equestrianplus.com to subscribe.
Well, it is our favorite time of the show in which we get to do a little window shopping for new horses that we should or should not be bringing home with our friends at New Vocations. And we have Bridget from the Standardbred side with us today. Bridget, welcome back to Retired Racehorse Radio.
Hello.
So are you recovered from the makeover? You had how many horses? Three?
Four? I rode three and I had a client with one. So we had four horses down there this year. And I don't know what the answer to how many horses to take to the makeover is, but it's not three. It's definitely not three.
All right, noted. I think I got to see you once on the rainy day, and it was you guys looked a little
so wet, rainy, so wet.
That was a time. We don't need to do it again. It was fine.
I think I've gone swimming and not been that wet before. Yeah,
that was ridiculous.
Yeah.
But everybody made it through. Everybody had good spirits. So it all turned out for the best. All right. So before we get into our adoptable standardbred this week, I do have a question for you. And it is a question that may or may not, you know, I think I know already what this answer might be, and it's going to be, it depends on the horse. But what are some indications when you are working with a standardbred, whether it's a trotter or a pacer, that that horse might be ready to offer a canter? Because that's not a gait that they normally are asked to do very often. So I know that's like a big, big milestone in training.
So the, you know, one of the things I tell adopters frequently when they are working on it and, you know, they want to see if this horse has a canter, make sure that they're balanced under saddle first, because they've learned, you know, they've gone in shafts their whole life. And so they're just learning to go around corners. And even in a space that we find to be big as a riding horse person is a very tight bend for a horse that's been in shafts its whole life and then now has the added weight of a rider on top of them. So usually if they are doing a 20 meter circle, and it doesn't have to be pretty, you don't have to score like an eight on it, but if they're holding themselves well in a 20 meter circle and maintaining their gait, whether it be a trot or a pace, and you don't find that you're having to constantly keep after them to keep them going, fighting them breaking, then they're probably balanced enough to ask for the canter. I do find that the pacers especially tend to offer it before that. You will a lot of times find in the corners on a pacer, if you have a good solid trot going, they might fall into their canter a little bit in the corners. And the horses that do that, I will see if I can keep them going to encourage them to do that a little bit more. The trotters seldom fall into a canter ever. The trotters are going to be more work, all things considered, getting them to push past their, you know, trot into a canter. They may require outdoor space to get enough steam going to get them past that point into a canter. But you can work your canter on the lunge line as well. And so sometimes for the trotters, for the people that don't want to have to ride that racing speed trot before they push into the canter, I'll recommend working with an assistant that can control you on the lunge line and while you ride them. If you've got a horse that has already been willing to canter on the lunge line, then your ground person can dictate the speed while the horse helps itself balance with you on it. So that's another good one I like for teaching standardbreds to canter with a rider.
Yeah, that is such a good idea to like combine efforts, you know, and yeah, use the tools that you have. That is interesting because so many people, I think they want a trotter, right? Because they're like, oh, well, no, then you don't have to deal with the pace. And I'm like, in my very limited, admittedly, experience, I'm like, no, I find the pacers, the pacer that I've worked with to be much more versatile about, you know, getting a good balanced trot first and not being like, okay, I do this at race speed now, because that just hasn't occurred to him.
Right. Yeah. I find that frequently, people that are like, well, I want to do, you know, hunters or dressage, so it's got to be a trotter. Well, it doesn't. You know, you have to have a pacer that does want to trot more than pace, but I do find the pacers are a little easier to get into a canter. Now, there's nothing saying that the trotters can't or won't. You know, I've also had plenty of really nice trotters that have learned to canter and carry themselves very nicely. But on the whole, I do think it's a little easier to get those pacers to learn to canter.
Yeah, it makes sense. It's just like a different set of mechanics, like that you're teaching the trotter versus the pacer, which makes a lot of sense. So now, and I found like thinking about the actual footfalls of the pace, and this is funny, if anybody could see what I'm doing right now, I'm just like shimmying back and forth in my chair. Like the mechanics of how the pace works to the lope or the canter, I think are actually more similar than the trot to the canter.
Yes. And, you know, you will find those horses have a very lateral canter, and it still takes a while to develop a true three-beat gait on those standardbreds, whether they be trotters or pacers. It's not as natural for them. But like you said, that those mechanics of the pace into the lope or the canter are a little more similar than from the trot to the canter.
Yeah. And I don't, maybe you can tell me if this is kind of a common occurrence when my pacer loses a little balance or like loses the cadence in a corner at mm-hmm. the lope, he is more likely to slip into a little bit of a pace, but it's usually pretty easy to kind of bump him forward back out of that again. Yes. He just needs a little more room.
Yes. Yes. When the standard bred that we show, I've had several youth riders show him in dressage and hunters, and he's just a lovely little horse. The only time you'd ever catch him pacing would be that downward transition from a canter to a trot. There'd be a few of those pace steps in there while he figured out how to regain his balance and his rhythm.
Love that. Well, today you have a trotter for us to feature.
Yes,
correct?
I do.
Awesome.
I do.
You introduced this guy. You're like, we're going to do the hair. And I was like, the what? Oh, I immediately, as I was scrolling through the page, which one we were talking about. He looks like a delight. Can you tell us about Better in Pinehurst?
Yes. So this is Bryson, named for a golfer that won at Pinehurst. and also there's a beautiful track at Pinehurst. So he was actually named after the track, not after the golf course, but we thought it would be fun to combine the two with
his
name.
I'm glad you understand all those references, because that would have been completely lost on me. I was like, what is Pine? Okay, like golf, not a thing ever on my radar.
Right, me either. But it, again, there's a beautiful track there as well. So, you know, if you have somebody that likes golf and wants to drag you there, you can go look at the harness track also, which would be more fun for me than golf.
Excellent plan.
Anyhow, Bryson is a great big hairy trotter. He has that beautiful thick mane and tail that the trotters tend to have. And, you know, it's just begging to be braided and brushed and all of those lovely things. But he is just a big, chill dude, you know, very easygoing, has been very pleasant to ride. His trot is actually quite comfortable. You know, it's a very clear trot. It's not a gait, but it's not not jarring or overly difficult to ride. So it makes him, you know, pretty pleasant to ride around. And he could do a whole lot of things for people. I could definitely see him out in the hunt field. He has that air about him. You know, he could go do the show horse thing. He could go do the trail horse thing. He's really a blank slate right now. And again, just a big sponge. He just soaks up all his information and has been a delight to train.
Taking a look at his pictures, he looks like he would not be very difficult to get to canter, because it looks like he's showing canter out in the field for sure on his own.
Yeah, he's been pretty willing to do it on the lunge line and loose out in the field. Now, of course, he's a big boy. He's a solid 16 hands. So he is in that process where he's learning to navigate carrying himself around a circle in the arena. But I do not anticipate him being a tough one to get to canter.
Love that. Yeah, because you are a little shorter than I am. And I'm watching this video and I was like, oh, Bridget looks so petite on this nice, big-bodied boy. So yeah, everyone who's always wanting a big horse, this is the horse for you.
Yes. Here's your big horse. Yes.
Love it. And he is only six? Is that?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So just a young kid ready to go. Hopefully kind of done growing at this point, but he'll probably change his muscling as he develops for under saddle work. And yeah, he'll be a fun one to watch develop. So listeners, if any of you guys adopt this horse, please keep us in the loop, because I would love to see how this guy's body kind of changes as he develops for a different career.
Yes, as he goes from race fit to being a riding horse, he will start to muscle out and be just a big, handsome guy.
Love it. Well, remind folks where they can find Better in Pinehurst and all of the other standardbreds that you guys have available for adoption.
You can find them online at newvocations.org or horseadoption.com. Make sure to get your applications in. Even if Bryson is not the horse for you, we have so many wonderful standardbreds and thoroughbreds looking for homes. And once that application is in, you can jump right on that perfect horse just as soon as you see it.
You can find our show notes and links to today's guests on the website at horseradionetwork.com. Like us on Facebook and Instagram. Just search for Retired Racehorse Radio. Follow us on Twitter at Horse Radio. You can find me on Instagram at hotgirlsummer.ottb, and that is girl with a U. My email is rbeamer95@gmail.com.
You can find me on Instagram and Threads at The Horseback Writer, and my email is kristen@horseradionetwork.com. Thank you so much to our sponsors, Kentucky Performance Products and Equestrian Plus, and to our partners, New Vocations Racehorse Adoption Program and the Retired Racehorse Project. Don't forget to check out all the other shows on the Horse Radio Network, part of Equine Network, at horseradionetwork.com, and don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe.
Always embrace your chestnut mare
and cowside leg.